The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, this is Steve. There was a time in my life when I couldn't think of a better way to spend a day than going down to the local video store and renting a couple of movies on VHS. Okay, sometimes it was more than a couple. Sometimes it was three or four, five or six if it was a two-day rental. This is when I took those first tentative steps to becoming a cinephile. So, of course, included in those rentals were films by Welles, Kubrick, Kurosawa, David Lean, and Alfred Hitchcock. But the fact is, those cinematic masterpieces didn't exactly represent the majority of my rentals. There probably was just as much John Carpenter as there was John Huston. It wasn't that I didn't watch movies with subtitles, it's just that more often than not, they were subtitling Jackie Chan or Jet Li. And while I was beginning to learn about European filmmakers like Ernst Lubitsch, François Truffaut, and of course Austrian director Billy Wilder, the Austrian who appeared most frequently on my small TV was Arnold. Now, I have no idea how many times I rented Conan, Commando, Raw Deal, Running Man, and of course The Terminator, but I actually believe it was his performance in John McTiernan's Predator that solidified his status as a bona fide movie star. Oh, and one more thing. You know, I realize I might have given the impression that I was somehow all alone with that stack of VHS tapes. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. 80s action movies were definitely a communal event, whether it was over a case of beers with some college friends or hanging with the gang at my apartment in Walnut Creek. Nobody watched an Arnold movie by themselves. And that's why John and I wanted to share our Predator experience with all of you. That's right, this Friday, April 16th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, Predator is going live on our YouTube channel, where we can't wait to share this classic 80s action movie with all of you. Come ready with questions and comments, because Super Chats and Streamlabs will be open for business. So, if you haven't seen this movie, you've got some prep to do before Friday at cinephiles.net, where you can buy or stream Predator along with every other movie we've ever reviewed. And if you happen to support the show on patreon.com/thecinephiles, right now you could be listening to me interview not John Rocha the Outlaw, Schmodown legend, or co-host on The Cinephiles, but John Rocha the Geek Buddy, whose brilliant breakdowns of the latest geek TV have become staples on my podcast feed. We even get into a discussion of Falcon and the Winter Soldier. So, that's behind the scenes of the Geek Buddies on Patreon, and this Friday at 2 p.m. Pacific, The Cinephiles' second ever live stream on John McTiernan's Predator. Can't wait to see you then.
Welcome, everybody, to this brand new live episode of The Cinephiles. This is something that we're going to be doing every month, one episode a month, just going live, talking about whatever movie that maybe doesn't quite qualify for the full Cinephiles treatment, but a film that we know you all love. I am one of your co-hosts. Here I am, the Outlaw, John Rocha, joined as always by my brother over there.
Hello, I am Steve Morris. At what moment did you realize that we were brothers? Was it during the Cinephiles? Was it?
Well, I like to, if you're a friend, I call you a brother. That's how it works in my life. And I've lost brothers and I've picked up brothers. So it's a big family. It's a big family for sure.
It truly is.
And Steve, we're very excited. So many people in the chat already joining us. Sterling Jones, Justin Toner, A. Leva, Philip Hunt, Matthew Gremlich, so many cool. And Sterling Jones again. Yeah, just thank you all so much for joining us here live. As we said, this is something we're going to try to do every month. An episode of The Cinephiles Live, and we'll talk about either a subject or a film that's related to that subject every month, and it's a way for us to be more interactive with you all, and we love growing the brand of The Cinephiles, and we thought this is another way to kind of add a new wrinkle to what we do on the show. So we're going to be talking today about 1987's Predator, directed by John McTiernan, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Carl Weathers, Bill Duke, Jesse the Body Ventura, Sonny Ladham, and a number and a few other people here in this film. And of course, Shane Black as well, young Shane Black in this film, talking about inappropriate things throughout the whole movie before he dies. But we're going to get into all of this. And we also want to hear from you all. Send in your Streamlabs, send in your super chats. I have both open. Steve also has Patreon questions. So some of you patrons who are patrons of the Cinephiles, you've sent in questions about that you want us to answer. So we're going to do all of that today. So the Streamlabs address, it is in the description of this video. It's also pinned to the chat. So send it through there. Or if you want to send a super chat, we'll bring you on screen. And maybe if there's time at the end, maybe we'll put the link out for the patrons and then come in live and ask us questions. So Steve, Predator, 1987. Yes. I get to turn this around on you whenever I get to host the show live here. What's your first experience with Predator, and what was your experience this time with Predator?
Can I say one quick thing
first? Yeah, sure, please.
You know what occurred to me as we're talking about why we're doing these live streams?
Yeah.
You know what another reason to do these live streams is, and this is the perfect movie for it,
sure,
is that sometimes it's going to be more fun. Is that... Yes. I think for this movie, with the, you know, with all our cinephile supporters out there, it's going to be way more fun to talk about it with all of you.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
because it's that kind of film. So, in answer to your question, I saw Predator in the movie theater. I was a huge Arnold fan from Pumping Iron. We've mm-hmm. already talked about him on our episodes on Conan and Terminator 1 and Terminator 2.
Yeah.
So Terminator, I had watched over and over again at this point. I had seen Raw Deal at Commando many, many times, probably far more times than they're worth. And so when this came out, it was, of course, we're going to go to see it in the movie theater. And it's one of those, like, I had no idea it was going to be a really, really good movie. It so exceeded expectations for me. Mm-hmm. How about you?
Oh, absolutely. Listen, the first time we went to see it, I mean, this is John Rocha in his prime, teenage years prime. He has this kind of thing inside of him that loves to see these action films, these badass action films, dudes in muscles with muscles, you know, all of this, the Rambo stuff, the Predator stuff, Lethal Weapon. I mean, the 80s were just a treasure trove of great action movies that you can go back and enjoy still to this day. And the nostalgia of them still holds up when you watch them. And they're connected to a certain time in your life. If you were a kid or a teenager in the 80s, I think these action films were really a huge staple of your existence, and maybe a staple of your friendships at that time, because you all probably went to go see them together, or they're a staple of the conversations you would have on Monday morning. Did you go? Did you go? Did you get to go see? Did your parents take you? All of that, and you get to talk about the film and enjoy them. And I wouldn't be surprised if I had numerous discussions about Predator for sure, Steve. This is at that time. I think I'm a senior in high school, or just about to be a senior in high school when this movie came out, and I was a massive Schwarzenegger fan. Same thing, Pumping Iron, but also Conan and a couple other films beforehand. And this is the one, watching it this time for our show, this is the one where you really see him come into his own as a superstar. And it's like he's really in his prime here. He goes on for the next 4 or 5 years is really prime Schwarzenegger time, kind of culminating with True Lies. And of course, still around, still an influence in our worlds and in our lives. But this is really, as far as his movie career, this is prime Schwarzenegger for sure. What was your experience revisiting the film for this episode?
I literally have exactly the same thing in my notes about Arnold. I think that this movie, I think this is the movie that makes him a star.
Yeah.
Of a different kind, because I think Conan and Terminator, he's kind of, you know, an oddity, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And then there's Raw Deal and Commando. And I think if Predator doesn't happen, he continues to make Raw Deal and Commando. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like they're kind of cheap, kind of dumb action movies. Mm-hmm. But because Predator is so good. And I actually think this is the first movie where he's acting in a way. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like being the Terminator, it's not that being the Terminator wasn't acting and he's amazing in it, but he's like a character. He's like a person in a movie in a way that rather than he's Arnold, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. That's a great point, Steve. You look at, there are certain moments here where he's showing empathy, where he's as much of a badass as he is, there's real connection with, like when he sees the general for the first time, and there's, you can tell there's an actual relationship that he is bringing to that moment when he's like, been a long time, general. And then, you know, is it a little awkward with him and Carl Weathers? Yes. But that kind of develops as the film goes along. You can tell that all these other badass actors and also badass people who are established in their own careers, Sonny Lanham had been in 48 Hours. Certainly, Jesse the Body had done his thing as a professional wrestler. Bill Duke was going to go on to become a great director and film and actor as well. So, but all of them, you can tell they are openly and willingly being in service to Schwarzenegger as the major of these guys, as in charge of these guys. And that's the natural charisma that comes through with Schwarzenegger in this movie. Steve, you're absolutely right. He is acting in this movie. He commands the screen, and he's very believable in what could easily be a throwaway role, just painting by numbers. He brings more life to this character of Dutch than you think might be there.
Well, and I think part of it is bringing in a great director like John McTiernan. I mean, this is his first studio film, and nobody knew that this guy was going to, you know, after this, make arguably the seminal action film of the 80s with Die Hard. And he said an interesting thing that I was thinking about a lot, which is he says that the reason that he cast Carl Weathers is he wanted someone to help teach Arnold how to act. And what he was saying was that he needed to find someone who was genuinely a good actor. And Carl Weathers is a good actor.
Yeah, yeah.
And is big and physical and powerful so that he could earn Arnold's respect. Like it had to be someone that Arnold saw to some degree as a peer and that he could act off. And I honestly, this whole ensemble is really, really good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a great bunch of people.
You mentioned, as you know, we mentioned earlier, Carl Weathers, but you've got Elpidia Carrillo playing Anna. She's actually damn good in this movie.
Yeah.
One of the only characters to come back into Predator 2 with an interrogation scene. And she is kind of in the fandom. She is considered someone that people like, they've made dolls of her. If there's figures of Anna that you can buy, pretty incredible. And of course, she's been working consistently since this movie. She's recently been in the Mayans show that is the spinoff of Sons of Anarchy. Bill Duke, as we said, Jesse Ventura, Sonny Latham, Richard Chavez as Pancho. He does a great job as Pancho. Shane Black as Hawkins. And of course, R.G. Armstrong, the legendary R.G. Armstrong as General Phillips. So a good cast for sure. But John McTiernan kind of showing or giving us a preview of what's to come for him as a director. Steve, you make an excellent point. He goes on to do Die Hard the next year, Hunt for Red October 1990, then Medicine Man, Last Action Hero, Die Hard with a Vengeance, Thomas Crown Affair, The 13th Warrior, Rollerball, and Basic. And then he just kind of stops for a while, and he's apparently got something in pre-production, but not a bad career for a guy who starts off with a film like this. And this is produced by Joel Silver. So a number of A-list people behind this thing. Even though, in my opinion, it's still a B movie, it might have come closer to me accepting that it might be an A-list movie by the time I was done watching it this time, Steve. And I did not expect that.
Well, this is big news, people. This B list. What are you saying, that it's now like a B plus?
I'd say a B plus list movie, kind of maybe B plus, maybe A minus. That depend. I mean, there's the slow motion, slow motion deaths and the falling over, and that kind of bothered me a little bit. So that keeps it from being an A list movie, but it's certainly closer. When you watch this, but once they get rid of the Sandinistas or the rebels or whatever those people are that are in the movie really takes off and it becomes a horror slash thriller that really, really works.
I want to address this A movie, B movie thing in a moment, but based on what you just said, one of the things that McTiernan does so well, and it's something that he totally does in Die Hard, which is like, and again, I would say this is sort of a screenwriting thing, is that if you're going to have a movie where there's going to be a surprise, that terrorists take over the building or something like that, is that the movie that you're in before the surprise happens has to be a really interesting movie.
Right.
And so you're in Die Hard totally invested in John McClane and his wife and what are their problems. And she's, you know, this taken the other name and she just closed a big deal. And there's this guy who's on coke who's flirting with her and what's going to happen. That's totally involving. And then we get into the action of the film when Han shows up. The same, he does the same thing here, which is I'm totally involved in why is Carl Weathers with them and what is this mission and who was captured and what was Carl? Because obviously Carl Weathers, Dylan lied to them to get them to do this thing. And there's some other plot. And I would, and I was like, that's a good movie. And then this completely other thing happens. And I just think that's a, and here, so we've had this A-list, B-list conversation many times. So to again, define our terms, because you define it differently than me. This is your grade for the movie.
Yes, right? It's quality grade. Quality grade is what I mean. A-list versus B-list. That's my point, right? Is it an A-list movie or a B-list movie? And for me, I've always felt it was a B movie masquerading as an A movie because of the material and the approach to it. And John McTiernan wasn't established yet. Schwarzenegger had done Commando and Raw Deal. Those aren't really like ones to write home about overall. But this is maybe I think they surprised themselves with how good this movie was and how good it turned out to be. And Alan Silvestri's score helps, who does the Avengers score. Alan Silvestri's score really helps to elevate the movie as well.
Totally. It's because for me that when someone says A-list movie and B-list or A movie and B movie, because I'm a history guy, is I go to the old school studio definitions, which is they literally had their slate of A movies, B movies, and C movies. And the A movies were Gone with the Wind and, you know, those things. And the B movies were more like, for instance, Casablanca is a B movie because it had a smaller budget and they would be released in different theaters. And then the C, you know, so and B movies, but maybe would have gangster films or more action oriented things.
Some of the Westerns.
Yeah. And then the C movies would be horror movies and sci-fi and things that they just threw out there and were really cheap. Right. They didn't so Touch of Evil, for instance, is a B movie because that's because of where its budget was. The fact that they got Charlton Heston elevates it a little bit, but they weren't going to put it in the big thing. It wasn't going to play in Radio City Music Hall, you know, or the Chinese theater in LA. It was going to play in the smaller theaters.
Right.
So in that sense, I think Predator is totally a B movie. It wasn't a big budget. Arnold, you know, Raw Deal and Commando, those are B to C movies in terms of how much the studio is investing in them and what they think it's going to be. Yeah. In terms of a grade, I totally give Predator an A if we're talking about just grading the quality of the film for what it is. You know, it's like I'm not having it compete against Schindler's List. I'm having it compete against 80s action movies. And if I were going to put together, if there were some sort of top 10 show where people ranked things and I was going to rank 80s action movies without looking at all of them right now, there's a damn good chance Predator is in my top 10 80s action movies. It's really good.
I would 1,000% agree with you, especially after just watching Steve. Yeah.
If it's in your top 10 of a decade, then why does it not get the A?
Well, I think because of some of the things I pointed out, the whole, like, you know, the cheesy A-team people blowing up and spinning around, all that kind of stuff really kind of turns me off about the movie and makes it seem kind of like cheap in its approach. And so that's why I don't give it an A. You don't see that in Lethal Weapon. You don't see that in First Blood Part 2. You don't see that in a number of those 80s films. You see people dying, certainly, and they're blowing stuff up, but you don't see them do the slow motion. You know, that kind of stuff. That's really cheesy. I just hate that kind of jazz.
Hold on. Which gets a better grade, First Blood Part 2 or Predator?
Oh, man, that's a tough question. That's a tough question, but yeah.
Not to me.
I would say First Blood Part 2, I would put that over Predator, to be honest with you. I really would.
Yeah, I think First Blood is awesome.
Of course, First Blood is. Yeah.
That's a great movie.
That's an A movie in my mind, but yeah.
But the sequel is... and you know, and part of it is like you and I are at this point, we're the same age. But in the mid-80s, the fact that I'm 3 years older than you, I think, or I'm 2 years older than you. That actually makes a difference. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like the difference between me in college and you in high school to go see First Blood, that, to me, I was like, ugh, this is silly violence. I don't understand this. That's He's how I spoke when I was in college.
Dummies. Oh, good. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Cinema.
Exactly.
But no, he's freeing POWs, and the timing of that, when that was actually a real thing that we were talking about in the 80s, I think is very interesting. You could argue Schwarzenegger against these rebels. I mean, the Sandinistas, Nicaragua, this is very topical for what's going on at the time in the 80s as well, Steve, for sure. So, yeah. Okay, go ahead, but what?
Oh, I was just going to say topical-ish.
Yeah, right.
I don't think there's any actual politics or anything in this movie.
But what? When you were watching it this time, you know, we've been doing Cinephiles for so long, and like now when I watch movies even more than ever before, like my analytical mind is always turned on. And watching it this time, it was so great to take a break from watching some other highfalutin Oscar fare and just remember enjoying movies like this as a teenager. But also as I was watching, I was trying to like look at the symbolism and the meaning. Because sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, this may surprise you, but these 80s action films sometimes are about more than what you're watching on the screen. And this idea of an unknown attacker, this idea of a thing that you don't see coming, we've never seen before. Remember, 80s is also the time when AIDS comes into our world. AIDS comes into our life. This idea of this unseen thing that fades into the back, can hide in a human's body and be transmitted, and they have no idea how to stop it. They have no idea how to kill it. And I'm watching it in a little, and maybe I'm thinking too much into it, but in my mind, that kind of popped up, this idea of this thing that seems human-like, can fade into that, has camouflaged, but can cause destruction. And, you know, the shots of these guys skinned alive with their guts out, this idea of what a disease like that, how it can ravage your body from the inside out. And so I just was like kind of thinking that as I was watching it, not trying to give too much credit that they were thinking all that. But I mean, this idea of an unknown thing hunting you down that you have to find a way to hide your heat signature to defeat it is just very interesting.
I the AIDS thing had never occurred to me. My gut is if we talk to McTiernan and the writers, they probably hadn't occurred to them too. But now that you say it, yes, that is a perfect. It's the unknown killer that we can't see that is striking us at random. And it is very scary. By the way, do you know how Predator came into existence? What the origin story of is it?
Let's talk about it. So,
it is Rocky IV. And it was a joke. At the end of Rocky IV, someone's like, man, Rocky's going to have to fight an alien in the next movie. And that was the joke. And someone went, Rocky and then fighting an alien. And that is how they started doing this movie. And the two writers whose names I don't have in front of me, they did exactly what you're not supposed to do, which is they snuck onto the back lot and started just sliding their script under the door of people. You know, just sneaking it around. And it's like, that never works. It worked. One of the doors was Joel Silver. And he read the script and he gave it to Arnold and said, because they had just done Commando together.
Right.
And he said, what do you think of this? And Arnold's like, I want to make it. And apparently he loved like the Dirty Dozen and loved the Wild Bunch. And he's like, I want to be part of some crew going on some big mission. This sounds great. That's where this movie comes from.
It's so perfect. Yeah, Jim Thomas and John Thomas are the writers of this. And Steve, this is so perfect because both of these guys, Schwarzenegger and Stallone, are arguably the top action stars in the 80s, right? Going toe-to-toe throughout that decade, both doing military characters, right? Rambo is more of an introspective loner, an introvert, an emotional person who is damaged with PTSD from the war. Dutch is this, you know, cock swinging, hardcore, big muscly dude who loves to take on this thing, but to take on any challenge. But, and I love it earlier in the movie, because I've watched this movie in forever. So some of the things I forgot, but I love that earlier in the movie, when Carl Weathers is confronting him about this with the general and going like, hey, how come you didn't come with us to Libya? Blah, blah. He's like, because we're not assassins. We're a rescue team. So he has a morality to him.
Absolutely.
He has an approach to him. He's not a gung-ho soldier in terms of, I'll kill anything. He's a gung-ho soldier to pull people out. Rambo, same thing. He has to be talked into going to pull POWs out. This is a different situation, but each of them reflect a better part of the military, even though sometimes they get stereotyped for these roles in a certain way, that they're just action, action pieces that they kill a lot of people. There's more going on in the portrayals of both of these characters than people think or give them credit for.
I totally agree. And what you immediately get a sense, A, just from that exchange, we are not assassins.
Right.
But also all the little things you see as you get on the helicopter and go do the drop and all that stuff is this is a family, you know?
Right.
Like, these guys have been together forever. You can feel it. And the respect that they have for Arnold. And that's one of the key things is, like, you could have a bunch of skinny people, you know, who aren't that intimidating. And by contrast, Arnold would look like a giant. But instead, you get a bunch of, I mean, I don't know what is the most macho, testosterone filled movie, but this is on the list. You know,
pretty close. Yeah.
And by the way, I don't know if you've heard some of the stories about working out for this.
No, please tell us.
So, I mean, obviously all these guys are working out a lot because these are some serious bodies, particularly between Arnold and Jesse Body and Carl Weathers. So Arnold would get up at like 5 or 4 and say, let's go work out. And, you know, Arnold pushes everybody around. I mean, you've seen him in interviews and at that time of his life, and they would like the workout was, let's see here. I wrote some of it down. They'd run for 90 minutes. Then they'd lift for 2 hours. Then they'd run for an hour. Like, and what happened is each one's, particularly the competition between Jesse and Arnold.
Yeah.
Like, Jesse started working out another half hour, then Arnold would work out another hour, you know? And at one point, by the way, they were measuring their biceps, and Arnold and the person measures Jesse's bicep and says, oh, wow, your bicep's now bigger than Arnold's. And he goes, oh yeah. And he's just swaggering around with this. And then makes a bet with Arnold to measure their biceps, and Arnold's biceps are 3 inches bigger than Jesse's because he set him up. He told the guy to tell him that my arms are bigger.
And that's Arnold. That's classic Arnold, always with the pranks and the practical jokes behind the scenes to mess with people.
And here's what Carl Weathers did is this is his way of messing with everybody. He didn't work out with any of them. He got up at 3 a.m. and worked out when everyone was asleep because he wanted everybody to think that he had this body just naturally.
Just naturally. Yeah. That's brilliant. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the world of men. It is absolutely this kind of nonsense. Yo, and you can do that because, I mean, Schwarzenegger, this came out in 87, and he's 30 years old in 87. But you imagine, obviously, he's probably 29 when he's shooting this film. So he's still in his 20s. And that's kind of crazy to think about when you see how big he is in this movie, Steve, how much he looks like a man who's a little bit older than his age in this movie. Carl Weathers as well, Jesse, but the body as well. So they convey years in the military beyond their actual age by how they portray these characters and how they look as these characters, which really adds weight to what they're doing. You know, you immediately respect and appreciate this crew and a little bit fear this crew as well. And Carl Weathers confronting them and being essentially hazed throughout the movie by them shows you what's up.
You know what I'd love to do is just kind of go through some of these characters because they're so great.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we've already talked about Arnold. I love the thing that they set up with Carl Weathers, and I think this is a McTiernan choice because originally he's just supposed to be a bad guy.
Right.
And that what I love that they do with his character and that Carl Weathers plays so great is that we sense there's conflict between him and Arnold. Yeah. But in the end, just through his observing what's going on, he starts to really feel for these guys and feel responsible because he's the one who put them in this situation and then has a heroic death. Like, that's a great character arc.
Yeah, agreed.
What do you think about Carl Weathers in this movie?
I love it. And Carl is someone that people don't give enough respect to. And I love the fact that he kind of is still doing, no, not kind of, he is still doing his thing. And I love that people enjoyed his episode of The Mandalorian that he directed. So not only is he damn good back in front of the camera, he's just as damn good, in front of the camera, but behind the camera. So that is just a great thing to see, because he's one of these guys that people are like, oh, Rocky, oh, Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, rather. Oh, you know, other thing, Action Jackson, or Predator. But people forget, like, this guy he's a lifer. He has worked for years. He's carved out a life in this business. So he is a legitimately established actor. So coming into this, as you said, John McTiernan wanted him to teach Schwarzenegger acting. So you're seeing from the beginning that Carl Weathers is playing this character. They have a relationship. He obviously was one of these grunts with Schwarzenegger. He's become a corporate man, a company man in essence. So what's that play like? And it is through the progression of the film, as you said, Steve, that he realizes, you know, he's kind of put these guys into this situation and he does feel bad about them, even though he said at the beginning, I got smart. Why don't you get smart about the situation? He realizes, no, there's a real human cost. They're not, quote unquote, expendable assets. There's a real human cost to the things that he's sending out these guys to do. And he's experiencing it now, which changes him. And, you know, in a lesser actor, you don't sense that arc. But with someone like Carl, you really do.
You know, one of the things about actors, and I'd love to hear what you think of this, is that for me, you know, the job of an actor is to fake stuff. You know, that's their job, is to pretend. Yeah. I think in general, actors cannot fake smart. I think that's a really hard thing. Yep. Like, and you could see from Rocky, I mean, Carl Weathers' performance, you know, Apollo Creed is brilliant.
Yes.
And I don't think you can fake that. I think, and I think the intelligence you see with him, and that's why I think it's actually too bad that they, you know, Action Jackson is all they tried to do with him. It's like, I actually think that guy was a movie star and could have done, but you know, do it, you know, at the time, an African-American actor, they're not going to give him the chance, you know?
Yeah. Agreed. What's another character you want to get into before we
Duke.
Oh yeah. Bill Duke. Yeah. Mac. Yeah.
He is so, I don't know how they came up with what this guy is, but every mannerism, every moment, he just makes a meal out of.
Yeah.
It's just so good.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the whole shaving of the, you know, with a Bic razor, all that, such an interesting character. And, you know, dude, just like you said, these guys are all working out or whatever. They've also got to stand out in a certain way in the movie, right? Jesse's chewing the tobacco. Shane is telling the inappropriate jokes. Schwarzenegger's lighting the cigar the first time you see him. And then you see what Bill Duke is doing. He's just sitting in the back. He doesn't need to be in the front area. He's sitting in the back to shave, and that's his ritual to get clean for the fight. And I respect that madly.
Well, and he has this strange relationship with Carl Weathers' character, which is interesting, as the two African-Americans. But there's always these looks between them and this competition between them, and Bill Duke not trusting. Mac doesn't trust Dylan. You know, all that stuff that's going on. By the way, the razor thing, that was Bill Duke's idea.
Oh, that's smart. Smart. Yeah. And you can play with that too, Steve, because you've got a company man. So he sees him as a sellout, maybe not only just to the military, maybe even to his race. You're selling yourself for the white general, blah, blah, blah. That could be an underlying thing between them for sure. Because when Carl Weathers gives away their position that first time, and Bill Duke threatens him straight up. And then later they go together on the mission, the doomed mission, to try to get the Predator. So that has an arc, their relationship as well.
Can you imagine if someone in 1987, you walk out of this movie and someone comes up to you and says, by the way, two people in this movie will become governors of states.
That's a good point.
So what was your as a wrestling fan, what was your reaction to seeing Jesse the Body Ventura in this movie?
I remember watching it the first time being like, is this guy, because I mean, of course, he was a great character Or, of course, he's still alive, obviously. But when he was part of the WWE, he was a great character. Jesse the Body was awesome. He always hated Hulk Hogan. And you always felt like there was some real hatred behind the scenes. Like, it felt like Jesse was mad that Hulk became what Jesse kind of had laid the groundwork and superstar Billy Graham before him. So Hulk had kind of taken what they had done and really got in, went into the stratosphere. And you always sensed that Jesse didn't 100% feel like he was appreciated by Hulk for what he did to lay the groundwork for Hulk to be what he could be. And so there was that thing with him always, right? But he was always a guy who spoke his mind, told his truth. So when he was in this movie, he is so natural here, Steve, that it's a joy to watch him work. It's a joy to watch him be a part of these Schwarzenegger films and these action films. I've never seen an inauthentic moment from Jesse the Body in anything he's done as an actor. He's not trying to do Shakespeare, but he's going to give you reality in what he's doing.
Several things about him. One is that he was an actual Navy SEAL. And so he, you know, brought a lot of military experience. And I think, what's the other actor's name? The one
Sonny
who's
Sonny Landham?
No, not him. Other, what's his name?
The Latino actor.
Yeah.
Richard Chavez.
Yeah. He served in Vietnam. So he also brought.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot to this. One of the things I think so interesting, and Jesse is the perfect example of this, is that Commando is a ridiculous movie, and it knows that it's a ridiculous movie.
Yes.
This also is ridiculous in many ways, but it's doing it in such a charming way that it's able to, like, I mean, Jesse Ventura holding the minigun, that's just totally ridiculous. You know, it's like, there's nobody could do this. And one of the things McTiernan talked about on the commentary track is, like, it's, if you actually fired it would fire all its ammunition in 6 seconds. And it's 100 pounds of, like, batteries to make this thing work. Like, it's like several hundred pounds of stuff. No human could do this, you know, but it's awesome.
Yeah. But it doesn't stop them doing it in movies. People carrying a 50 cal. You can't carry a 50 cal and be effective in a theater of war, ladies and gentlemen. That's unrealistic, but it looks badass in a movie like this. That's for sure. Because I guarantee you it wasn't 100 pounds to carry that thing around necessarily. We've got some super chats. Should we read some of these before we get into more of the movie? All right. Paul says, here he says, the co-stars really elevate this movie. Predator wouldn't be great without them. Yeah, I think we both agree with that, Steve.
100%.
Yeah. Paul says, don't forget Total Recall, guys. That is one of the best Arnold movies.
So I was very disappointed in the Total Recall, mostly because of the end. And I haven't seen it in a really long time.
Right.
But I think the whole setup of Total Recall is awesome.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I wanted something else at the end. And it gets a little silly at a certain point to me. But there's so much great stuff in that movie.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you. I would like to revisit it again. It's been a very, very long
since
I've watched it. And it's a little cheesy at times, so I wonder if maybe it's a little bit better now in retrospect watching it again. Justin Toner says, I consider this one of Arnold's best films, period. One of his best acting jobs, great supporting cast, great action and suspense.
Yep, I agree.
1,000% agree with that statement for sure there, Justin Toner. Thanks for watching us here. Jason Earhart says, wow, Casablanca is a B movie? Steve dropping knowledge bombs. There you go.
That's my job. I should put that on my business card.
Steve dropping Morris. Knowledge bombs.
Dropping knowledge bombs.
Let's see here. Philip Hunt says, The Thing in 1982 and this film are very similar. Very charismatic leads, iconic moments, great supporting cast. Which is better for me, The Thing? Yeah, I'd have to agree. The Thing is better than Predator. There's no cheesy slow motion falling out of nest things with people on fire moments. And it's more alien than it is Predator, in my opinion. What do you think?
I think, I would rather watch Predator. I think The Thing is a better movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, because The Thing... I don't, you know, The Thing is uncomfortable and difficult and, you know what I mean? Like, whereas the Predator is just fun and silly. So I would rather watch Predator, but I agree. I think The Thing is a better movie.
Let's see. You got one from Paul here. He says, favorite line and scene in Predator, Steve. Ooh,
that's tough. Well, I think there are several things that need to be honored. You know, okay. the handshake bicep shot is one of the most iconic things in film. And you know, and things like I Ain't Got Time to Bleed and all those, you know, those are all really good. My favorite, one of the most interesting sequences to me is the turnaround with the scorpion and all of that and him pulling the knife. And that's just such a tension filled moment that's that those two actors really make work really well. What about you?
I think there's two for me for different reasons, but both very, I don't know what you'd say, alpha male. When, what's Sonny? Oh, I forget. I always forget Sonny Ladham's character's name. Oh, Billy. When Billy stops on the tree stump on the bridge and you sense this is a Native American situation, that he is going to fight this thing and it is in his blood from generations, which is why I think the film kind of is a kind of cheapens the moment by not showing the battle with the predator and giving him his just due, showing what he can do as a warrior. And I wonder why you'd edit out a fight like that. Maybe it's tough to fight on that piece of thing, but that tree stump, but I would have liked to have seen that. And I love when he got ticks everything off, boom, cuts the cross and he's ready to go. And then I love the moment with Schwarzenegger right before he's going to take on the Predator when he's lit every, he's got that fire in the dark and he just goes, rah! You know, that kind of unleashing a primal scream of rage and warrior mentality because he's about to go into battle possibly for the last time. So I love those two scenes for sure.
Totally. I am certain the reason they didn't film that battle is because they couldn't. You know, right, is that true. I mean, they had so much trouble. The first, so here's some more trivia, is the first Predator was Jean-Claude Van Damme. He was the actor supposed to be Predator.
What?
And when they brought him to set, because they're like, and this is pre, this is before anyone really knows about him. Crazy. And they're like, because he moves so well, and we want someone that can move so well in the suit.
Right.
And he gets there, and I don't know how tall he is, but he is not tall. And he's around all these huge guys, and it's like, we can't have a short Predator. Right. That doesn't work. And the suit that showed up was horrible, and they threw it out. And so a lot, they couldn't film a lot of the stuff early in the production with the Predator because they didn't have the actor and they didn't have the suit. The guy they got, whose name I don't remember, but he's over 7 feet tall. Yes. And the suit is designed by Stan Winston, who apparently was on an air. This is what he says, was on an airplane with James Cameron. And James Cameron said, I always liked mandibles and was like sketching stuff. And they were talking about it. And that's what started the idea for what would later become the Predator suit. Wow. But all the Predator suit weighed a ton. It weighed like well over 100 pounds. And this is a really big guy who didn't move that well in the suit. Like one of the things they did to make the suit, to make it look cool, was there's one scene where you kind of see the Predator sort of making these big jumps.
Yeah.
He's strapped into bungee cords so that he's bouncing a little bit. And that's what makes him able to move. Cause this guy couldn't move that much in that suit. It was too heavy. Right, so I'm sure that's why they didn't film it. I love the Billy character. I love the fact that he's scared, you know, like, and that's what makes it all so much scarier. By the way, apparently, I don't know if I believe this, but for the actor, they had to hire a bodyguard. Not to protect him, but protect other people from him.
Wow.
That's what they said, that he was such a brawler and would just so regularly get in drunk and get in fights at bars and stuff.
Oh, shit.
That they actually had a big, huge dude to protect, to keep him away from hurting people. That's what they said. I don't know if that's true, but that's what was said.
I love that because I remember him in, like I said, 48 Hours and this, and he was also in Lockup. People might remember that Schwarzenegger film, Lockup. Mm. He was in The Warriors as well.
Yeah,
he certainly had a good career for a few decades. Also, I would say, what's the other the favorite line? I don't know if I have a favorite line. It's not "Get to the chopper," that's for sure. Maybe it's "Dylan, you son of a bitch." Maybe it's that. Maybe it's that's my favorite line. We'll see. All right. We have, let's see. Paul goes, what do you guys think of Predator 2? LOL. I don't really think of Predator 2 ever. But
I was so excited to go see it. I remember going to not the Cinerama Dome in Hollywood, but the Dome in Concord, which was kind of the cool local movie theater in that area. and you know, did the thing we've talked about many times, like, okay, this could be good. Yeah, maybe it's good. It could still be a good, no. And like halfway through going, this is terrible. I only saw it, that's the only time I ever saw it. I don't think I've ever seen it since. It's not a good movie.
And I think that's they tried to secure Schwarzenegger to come back with the actress who plays Anna, Elpidia Carrillo. They tried to secure them coming back to have like a debriefing scene. And that's what they would watch in the truck to understand what they were facing in the movie in Predator 2, but they couldn't secure Schwarzenegger coming back. And why would, I mean, Schwarzenegger at this point is massive, and they probably had to pay like a lot of money just to have him do one or two scenes. So why would you do that, for sure? All right. And a couple of Streamlabs real quick here, Steve, from Jason Earhart. He says, you guys are awesome. Thank you so much for all the work that you do. Predator is such a great action movie. The scene in the helicopter with Long Tall Sally got me so hyped as a little kid. Such a great 80s movie. Yeah, Steve, do you like the?
Thank you.
Do you like the? Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Do you like the blaring of the?
Totally. And I think what, you know, this movie owes a lot to Alien, and it owes a lot to Aliens. Like, and I think that sequence is such an Aliens kind of sequence of getting to know the characters, really fun. Well, and then bringing the completely bizarre rendition of Long Tall Sally from Bill Duke at the end of the film, or, you know, before his death. And by the way, that whole sequence of his death and Carl Weathers' death is great.
Yeah,
it's really, really well done.
What's great about, because you buy into the fact that these guys are going to give this Predator a hell of a fight. And it's over in seconds, man. It's over in seconds. And it's the Predator who really gets the jump on both of them. It does not default to a cliche situation throughout most of the movie until the end. And you got to give it some respect for that, for sure. Anything more you want to add to that? Or should we ask a couple more of these, bro?
No, let's do a couple more.
Okay. Ethan Murphy says, do you see Predator as a slasher movie where the horny teens are archetypical 80s action heroes?
I think that is a brilliant, brilliant metaphor. Yes. Well done. Good job.
Absolutely. They're scantily clad.
Yeah.
And they are.
They get taken out one by one.
One by one. There's all shocks and surprise. There's penetration. So yeah, it's all there. It's all there. So, Ethan, bravo to you for that observation, for sure. Brennan is here. Brennan, thank you. He goes, I saw this film for the first time last year, and it was awesome. Also, I love the Bad Batch team in Star Wars The Clone Wars because they remind me of the guys from Predator. That's a great point. Certainly not a mistake, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lineage between the Dirty Dozen, Predator, and, you know, Clone Wars, and yeah, I mean, totally, those are all connected.
Certainly the lead of the Bad Batch, that bandana he wears is an homage to both Rocky and to Billy in this movie. So that's the look of him, too, is more Native American than Rocky. So certainly Billy probably influencing the look of that character for sure. Let's see. And thanks, Brennan. Appreciate it. And Ethan Murphy sent us one more thing. Do you see Predator as a, oh, he sent it again. Sorry, Ethan, you sent it again. So we already read it. Thank you very much. And then Fillmore Pockets just donated or just sent a few bucks for Super Chat, which we appreciate. Thank you, Fillmore.
So much.
Where would you like to go next, Steve?
Well, we got some questions from Patreon. If you support the Cinephiles on Patreon, frequently we'll let you know what movie we're doing early, and B, give you the opportunity to ask some questions. So here's our first one, comes from Sterling Jones, and he says, first one comes from Benji Black. What is it about Predator that has made it so hard to make a sequel or a reboot of it?
I think because the first one is so damn good, anything you do afterwards is going to be compared to it, and most people fall short trying to create anything that comes close to it. I mean, Shane Black went back to the well and directed his version of Predator a few years ago, and it was horrible. He didn't understand. I mean, a guy who was in the movie, and iconically in the movie, didn't understand what made Predator so great, and instead trying to create a super Predator. And like, people just forget yes, do we want different things? Sure. But we also want a damn good movie. So if you're going to default to the basic construct of the movie, you can still do that. You just have to find new and inventive ways that are interesting and fun to see this chase go down. And I thought Predators was the closest they came to a good movie in this franchise after the first one. What about you, Steve? What do you think, Steve?
I think, well, we also have a question from Sterling Jones that relates. So he said, going off Benji Black's good question, could Predator have a successful sequel? If it does, do they, whoever they are, need to start from scratch? So I think the reason that Predator doesn't have good sequels is that Hollywood is stupid and they make bad choices. I mean, this is absolutely perfect material to do other movies from, because there's so little that's trapping you. All we know is there's this alien species that likes to hunt people, you know, and it's like we could create good characters and create a good situation that has that. It's like, I think it's what you said too. It's trying to duplicate what we had before, you know, and do it again. That's where you get into problems. And then, you know, I think studios messing with, I mean, I don't know that this is true, but all of those Predator movies feel like studios messing with stories that could have been good.
Yeah.
Like for me, there's no reason that you can't do a good Predator film.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point, certainly, for sure. All right, do we have more?
Sure. This is from Matthew Gramlich, and he says, I love this movie in spite of its male chauvinism. It's an interesting thing of whether or not this is a male chauvinist movie. Oh, it's manly, but I don't know if it's chauvinist. So naturally, my question is, who would win in a fight between Carl Weathers and Jesse Ventura? In all seriousness, okay, so first of all, let's just address that.
Okay,
Jesse Ventura would win.
Yes,
The guy's a Navy SEAL. Yeah,
yeah.
And you know way more about wrestling than me, but there are fighting skills in there. You know, sure.
And you know, Carl Weathers wasn't trained to be a fighter in real life. You know what I'm saying? He's a boxer for the Rocky movies, and of course, in this film, he hardly gets any real fight scene without a weapon, and when he does, he's killed almost immediately. So I would think Jesse would win. Go ahead.
Yeah, he was. I think Carl was an athlete. I think he played like college football or something. But but then his question goes on. He says, in all seriousness, the question the movie raises for me is about technology. If we accept that the human body is in its own way a tool for accomplishing certain tasks, then the soldiers in this story are exemplary tools, the best humanity has to offer. The Predator has superior technological advantage. Mm-hmm. So long question. Sorry. We can assume it is also the best of its species it has to offer. So when Arnold defeats the superior opponent using rudimentary technology, what is that supposed to make us feel? Mm-hmm. Is it simply an underdog story, or is there a deeper question being posed? Is the film a commentary on emerging technologies and the role of humanity in this new landscape? If so, what does the Predator represent? What is the emotional nature of humanity's victory in this story? Where do we fit in the potentially limitless potential of technology in a natural world? Also, if you guys had to cast one of the characters, had to be cast as one of the characters, who would you be? Looking forward to this episode. There's a lot in that question.
Yes, there is. Care to tackle any of it, Steve, first?
I think the idea of this being about technology is really interesting. I think that's sort of a classic movie thing, is we're going to go back to basics. That's how we're going to win. You know, like the and sort of the putting together the traps and all that stuff. Like you think of Jaws when they're, you know, they're going to put the cage down in the water. We're going to end up at mano a mano because it's the most interesting. One thing that McTiernan said, so there's the giant contact, you know, everybody firing all of their weapons, including the minigun, into the jungle and hitting nothing.
Yeah.
So the McTiernan said an interesting thing about this that relates to this, which is that the studio kept telling him, we got all these guns. We got to use all the guns. People like to see people firing guns. Guns are awesome. Guns are cool. And McTiernan didn't want to do that. And what he said is that the way that he ended up doing it is that he said, I gave the studio what they thought they wanted by giving them exactly the opposite of what they were saying. Because his point in that particular scene is that you have all these guns, and this is what his word was, they are essentially impotent because they hit nothing. you know, is that it's actually what it, instead of showing how awesome all these guns are, it's showing how completely ineffectual all this technology is, which I think relates to Matthew's question.
Yeah, it's a great point. And also, Steve, when you look at this film as the story goes along, right? The Americans, or, you know, I imagine the Americans are the people who have the better technology and the better knowledge going in to attack these rebels, right? They're the ones who have the better technology. The rebels are the ones who have a little more rudimentary technology, and they're easily wiped out, except for Anna. And then the Americans have to confront, they're now the rebels in comparison to the Predator, who has better technology and whatever. And remember, Schwarzenegger stumbles on the advantage. It's not, he didn't think of it. He didn't like process it and troubleshoot it and figure it out. He stumbled upon it only because he, you know, came out of the water into mud, and his heat signature was hidden by what the Predator, so the Predator couldn't see him. So those things are stumble. And I think it just says that at the end of the day, you can have all the tools in the world. What matters is who is using the tools. That's always the difference between success and failure. Everyone has the possibilities, or if they get an opportunity for these possibilities, it's the people who take advantage of these possibilities and can figure out a situation are the ones who succeed all the time. We see it all the time. Underdogs win because underdogs come in, are more focused, are less, feel the pressure less, and they have the same tools as the people that are supposedly favored to beat them. They just have a little more focus in administering it and a better game plan in the situation. So that's all. I don't know if it's technology versus, I think it's more about who you are.
I think that's a great point. And I think, you know, the Predator also, when he takes off his helmet or whatever at the end, he's going, oh, you want to go mano-y-mano or mano-y-predator? Let's go. You know? And so he's buying into the same sort of primal thing that's happened at the end of the movie. Our next question comes from Jeff Cook. He says, he has two questions, actually. He says, could you speak generally about the sci-fi trope in which a crew of competent military scientific professionals encounter alien life well away from civilization? Alien, Star Trek, The Thing, The Abyss.
Okay.
Do you have thoughts of this trope?
I didn't know it was a trope. But I don't understand the question necessarily. What is to be said about the trope that scientists are always overwhelmed by another species? Is that what they're saying?
I think he's just saying this idea that we go far away and that's where we encounter alien life. I wouldn't quite call this a trope, but I do think, you know, things are scarier when you're away from civilization. That's just, you know, if I can call the police and the police come in 5 minutes, it's not as scary as if I'm in the middle of the jungle fighting something and you're, that's just ups the drama for me.
Yeah. I think a part of this also, Steve, is hubris, the hubris of scientists to think that they can navigate a foreign situation with an alien life form or an otherworldly life form. And they can intelligence, or how can I say this? They can science the shit out of it. And you can't always science the shit out of it. And it's a little bit of hubris. Like we just saw, I don't know if you saw that news article, I'm sure you did yesterday, how scientists have now created the first cloned half human, half monkey or chimpanzee embryo. What the fuck are you doing? Like, it's just this kind of thing. But that's scientists, because there's still a majority of them are still male. There's still dick measuring contests, even amongst scientists, bro. And that's the frustrating part of it all. It's like, oh, let me just create it because I can, you know? And it's like, they never learn the lesson. And when that thing gets created and eats them alive inside of a laboratory and gets out, thank you. Thank you for your hubris and your desire to mess with something that you should be messed with. There's an arrogance sometimes in scientists thinking they have the power of God at their fingertips.
I think that those disasters, the mad scientist stuff, happens way more in movies than it does in reality. Like, the bigger ones, certainly technology being used by big industry has pollution and all those things. That's definitely how science has messed us up. Like, I actually don't think we've had too many examples of a piece of science, but of course, if it ever does happen and a piece of science does go out of control, we're in deep shit. His second question is a really good question. Is the best Arnold overmatched and imperiled Arnold, Conan, Predator, Total Recall, or strong and in charge Arnold, Terminator, Pumping Iron, Commando? What do you think?
I think the first one. And I'll tell you 100%. Why, because Arnold, in essence, by coming to this country, became American, and not just by citizenship or anything like that. He came to embody America in that. And I've said this, recently, and I've been saying this over and over again. America is at this is simultaneously wants to see themselves as the number one country in the world, the number one superpower, and an underdog at the same time. And Schwarzenegger, when he is playing the underdog, even though he looks like a guy who shouldn't be outmatched in any situation, it makes us connect with him more, right? Comics always say, if you're a good-looking person or for a person in shape, the best way to become a good comic is to be self-deprecating, undercut all of that, make fun of yourself, destroy yourself so the audience feels a relatability to that. The same thing with Schwarzenegger. We shouldn't connect to a guy who is a champion, constantly wins at life, lifts weights, looks fantastic. It's putting him in the underdog situations that make us connect in a universal way with what he does on screen.
I 100% agree. And that's the way story structure works is you need the bad guy to be more powerful than your good guy. Yeah. It has to be a desperate situation. If it's not, it's not interesting. And it's funny, the three examples of the not underdog, they are two that are really exceptions. And there's the third that doesn't really work. So Pumping Iron is a documentary, you know, and it's about the most dominant bodybuilder in the world and his personality and that's what it is, you know, but that's not like, we don't have 10 Arnold documentaries where he struts around. That would mean that interesting. Right. Terminator, he's the bad guy, you know? Mm-hmm. And so he's the one who has to totally overmatch the good guys. That's his job, which he does. Terminator 2, he is overmatched because the T-1000 is way more powerful. And Commando, I know people love Commando, including some good friends of mine. That is exactly what's wrong with that movie, Arnold is too powerful and nobody can actually stand against him. And that's not a good movie.
I agree. You know? And I love that Predator keeps the non sequiturs to one.
Yeah.
He throws a knife and he says, stick around. And thank God McTiernan cut. There were probably 10 more. And I hope to God McTiernan cut them all out because it really takes away from the movie. You know, and you can see, once again, you see the progression, you know? Yeah.
I have more Patreon questions, but do you want to switch and do some Streamlabs or Super Chats?
Oh, yeah. We just got a couple more that have come in here. Paul says, this is bittersweet. No more Arnold movies? Hmm. He occasionally works, right, Steve?
Does he mean Arnold's not going to make movies or are there no more Arnold movies to do on the Cinephiles?
No, there's still some Arnold movies to do on the Cinephiles. Yeah.
I mean, the dude's in his 70s. Like, you know, he's done his work.
Yeah. I mean, he just did what? He just did Terminator Dark Fate. He's also the voice in Predator Hunting Grounds, a video game that came out last year. He plays Dutch again. He's got a superhero kindergarten coming up, a Skydance project, Kung Fury 2, Triplets, The Legend of Conan, and Outrider. So we're not done with Schwarzenegger films for sure. He's got a while to go.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Derek Noonan says, awesome show, fellas. Keep dropping Predator knowledge bombs on us. Well, thank you very much, Derek.
Thank you, Derek.
Let's see if I got any Streamlabs that have come through. No Streamlabs. Ladies and gentlemen, send in if you got questions. We'll probably be on for another half an hour. So if you want to send questions or any thoughts or comments about it, you want us to read on the screen, send it through the Streamlabs. The address is pinned in the chat. It's in the description. And eventually we'll get a graphic where you'll see it on the screen in case you need that as well. So, Steve, where would you like to go to next on this discussion?
Well, I got more Patreon questions. This one is from, you know, he told me how to say his name a while ago.
Okay.
And I'm still not going to get it right, but Jono Schaefer Cotter asks, who's always been a great supporter of the Cinephiles, why do you think some gear shift movies work better than others? Do you think Predator's genre shift works so well because the hint at the opening with the spacecraft crashing, and maybe Dusk Till Dawn isn't as well received because it doesn't offer any hint to the audience? Thanks for all the hard work. Love hearing you two discuss movies. Please never stop.
That's a great question, Steve. Teasing the sci-fi movie at the beginning, then turning it into a regular, you know, rescue mission, shoot 'em up type ground-based action film, and then boom, we're going right back into the sci-fi aspect of it all, and in essence becoming a horror film. Yeah, the tease actually makes sense, and I think that's you. I know, God forbid us questioning Quentin Tarantino, but certainly the I'm sorry, Robert Rodriguez. Certainly the teasing
well, it's
of
both
the
vampires. Yeah.
Right, that's right. Certainly the teasing of the vampires at the beginning would have maybe been more effective for the overall construction of the movie.
Well, Dusk Till Dawn is a real edge case, because that movie is, and I've heard something about that, this is in fact the truth, is that Quentin Tarantino wrote half a script that he never finished, and Robert Rodriguez wanted to make a vampire movie, and so they just put them together. And the reason that movie doesn't work is it's like, it's not just a shift change, it's like two completely different movies, right? You know, and you have all these story threads of the creepy Quentin Tarantino character and his brother, and they're, you know, hijacked this RV, and Harvey Keitel and the relationship with the dog. And then we just throw all that out and do a vampire story halfway through. It that doesn't work at all. I don't think the tease necessarily is that necessary for me, because you know what movie you went to see. You saw the trailer, you saw the commercial, you saw the poster. You know there's going to be some crazy alien that we're going to have to fight. I think, and the thing too is the story threads in terms of the relationship with Dylan, the friendship with, you know, that those things that exist, they're all carried through the whole film, you know.
Yeah.
Those don't shift, and it's a good movie. I mean, that's the biggest key.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you this. Watching it this time around, is there anything that stood out to you that you didn't like? You know, we've been praising the film and talking how much we enjoyed it, but we got to be fair as well. Is there anything that you didn't like this time around? Anything you'd love them to cut out or would have changed if you were making this movie or on the set with McTiernan?
That's a great question. I think I wish there was a little more with some of the supporting characters. I wish they had more to flesh them out a little bit more. I think that's the thing that I would like, because I like all the characters so much and they do a lot with very little space. But I would have liked more Jesse and Mac and their relationship, you know what I mean? I would have liked to develop the Carl Weathers Arnold conflict more. I think there was more that could have been done there. But what about you?
That's a great point to bring up, both of them. Yeah, because Bill Duke has that kind of touching moment with Jesse the Body Ventura's body. There, you know, has the drink and puts the flask down with him and says, you know, rest easy, brother, or rest in peace, brother. So certainly there was, you know, and he wants to catch the predator because that was his friend that the predator killed. So there's more here. They've been on more missions. So maybe there was time for that classic scene in action movies where you talk about old adventures over a beer by the campfire or whatever, or have separate scenes where you discuss that. And I agree with you, a little more with Carl Weathers and a little more so we can see even more concretely the arc of Carl Weathers' character throughout the movie. I think Anna gets a lot of surprisingly good moments for someone who's thrown in about 45 minutes into the movie. And I think she has some really good moments as well. But I would like to have seen a little more with her and Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, me too.
When we find out they're the last two left alive throughout this whole sequence. Because I love this, that Dutch tells her, don't pick up a gun. That's such a great, great surprising element to this movie. Don't pick up a gun, because then he'll kill you. He doesn't see you as sport if you don't carry a gun, you know, a weapon.
I would have loved to see more with her. I love the moment, you know, that she obviously does speak English, but is pretending that she doesn't speak English.
Right.
And when she does finally start speaking, I also really, really like that there isn't even a hint of romance in this film.
Yes.
That would be such a cliche to fall into, and they don't do it, which is great.
Well, and real quick, Steve, also what speaks volumes to these actors is they don't, as Justin Toner points out here in the chat, they don't turn into caricatures. So the limited screen time they do have, they're able to fill these characters with life to make them feel realistic. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Jono has another question. He says, I also feel that McTiernan masterfully embraces and satirizes the action genre. He lures you in with fun, dumb action, but then flips, elevates when he transforms the strongest heroes into teenage camp counselors in a slasher movie. Hey, same metaphor. Do you feel like that's one of the winning formulas in screenwriting? Lure people in with simple, easily understood genre fun. Then once the audience is settled, have a second act shift into something more complicated, deep. It's a concept you've mentioned before on the podcast. Sorry for the long questions. Thanks for everything.
Is that a truth, Steve? Do you think that McTiernan was doing that?
I think there is an awareness of the goofiness of the movie that is definitely embraced,
okay.
You know, with the minigun, some of the overtop stuff. Yeah, I do think so.
Okay. I wonder if he's doing that because he doesn't satirize in any of his other movies. Like there's no satirizing in Die Hard. There's no satirizing in Hunt for Red October. There's no satirizing in some of his other movies that
Last Action Hero.
Well, that's a full on. That's a full on obvious one, right? So I don't know if I would agree that he's satirizing. I think he's just making
satirizing it. Totally not what it's not a satire. Yeah. He's aware of the silliness. You know, he is fully embracing. He's completely stepping into the over the topness, you know, the minigun and I ain't got time to bleed and all these, you know, these are bigger than life characters. He's jumping in.
You know what he's maybe doing is, and I think this is maybe an element to what they're saying. And I think I agree with this is he is in essence undercutting this idea of overt male masculinity, of toxic masculinity. And certainly his films carry that because Bruce Willis is not someone in that movie that you expect to be an action hero. You know, he's a cop, but he's not like, you know, some kind of special forces trained cop who's dropped into this building to save you. No, same thing with Hunt for Red October. Alec Baldwin is someone you would easily overlook and he's constantly overmatched, but he seems to figure it out and puts himself in these situations to become a hero. So not your standard heroes throughout. Even Banderas in 13th Warrior is an underdog of a hero who kind of subverts the male masculine approach to war. So maybe that's what he's more highlighting or underpinning, not necessarily action movies overall, just the idea of masculinity overall is what he's undercutting in these movies.
Well, and it's what we said before of like, he creates situations where people are overmatched. Yes. You know, obviously that is what is Die Hard's greatness and why the sequels can never match it. Right. It's because once John McClane shows he can fight 20 terrorists, then he doesn't seem as overmatched anymore.
Right.
You know, by the way, this is the idea of using a certain genre to then shift it or twist it is totally a thing that I love. It is a thing that I've done in multiple screenplays that I've written, including The Assistants, which is totally the caper genre that hopefully tries to become more dramatic as it goes along and doesn't give as easy answers. My favorite screenplay, which I've never gotten produced, the whole concept is you think it's one kind of an action movie, like a post-apocalyptic action movie. And then at the end of the first act, you find out that everything you thought about the world is wrong. But that's not what's going on at all. Right. So I love that kind of film.
Okay. Do we have more questions from the patrons? We've got some.
Sure.
Okay.
Here, I'll do one more and then maybe we'll switch over.
Yep, sounds good.
Okay, this is from Brennan Marr, great supporter of the show. He writes, I was thinking of approaching this from the angle of George Lucas's career, including Star Wars, in the era of New Hollywood. If you could bring your expertise and knowledge... Oh, wait, no, this is a cinephile short topic. This is not a Predator topic.
Okay.
But it's a good question, Brennan, about the new wave of Hollywood, and we'll get to it in an upcoming cinephile short. Sorry about that.
Absolutely,
Brennan. And someone else had asked about the fact that, because I don't have that question in front of me for some reason, but someone else had asked about the fact that this is in the news right now because the writers of Predator are suing Disney over the rights to Predator.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that, Steve? Have you looked
at this? I think that they should get their damn rights back. And this is to me, a perfect example of a big, big, huge, powerful corporation, being mean to the little guy to me.
Wow. Yeah, Jim and John Thomas suing Disney for the movie rights. But so Disney, I didn't know Disney. Oh, because of Fox. Is that why?
It was Fox. And their contract was that the rights would revert to them in 2017 or something. Oh. And Disney is saying, no, no, you have the right to that screenplay. We have the right to the character. That's what I think they're saying. And it's like, look, okay, Disney, you want to maintain the rights to this intellectual property? Okay. Give them a bunch of money. Give them, you know, it's like, don't, you know, like this is this great thing that they created 30 years ago.
Right.
You know, they deserve something. Give them some, give. Yeah, it bugs me.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Wow. Okay. Any more questions or should we jump into the Streamlabs Super Chats?
Let's jump into Streamlabs.
Okay. Oh, real quick. Billy's, there was rumors for years of a death scene with Billy, a deleted death scene from Predator, but it appears to be a myth. However, you can find his death in the novelization. Paul Monette's novelization of Predator, the hunter, Predator swiftly dispatches him by, quote, slicing through the Indian's jugular and then zigzagging down his chest and belly like a mockery of some tribal blessing. Wow. Wow. Mm. That would have been powerful to see on screen for sure. All right. See here. Alex Ainsworth says, what was your reactions when you saw the alien skull on the Predator ship for the first time in Predator 2 and realized the possibilities?
Well, I loved that. Apparently, by the way, they wanted to show the interior of the Predator ship in this movie. Mm. And McTiernan refused because he thought it would be cheesy. I love that idea about the alien. And at the time that Predator 2 came out, I'm pretty sure it was when I was working in a comic book store. And so that's also when like the Alien versus Predator comics were coming out. And, you know, I thought it was awesome. What about you?
Yeah. When I saw it, it was such a bad movie that when I saw it, I was like, okay, so they're connected. Like it just didn't carry weight because it's a terrible movie. So the moment died for me, because the movie was bad. So that's all I can tell you. But AVP, when it came out as a comic book, was awesome. And that was great. And then I think the first one of those is the only watchable one of those series of AVP movies. But it's nice to know they're still in the same universe. And at some point, maybe down the road, someone will create a damn good crossover between those two. All right, we've got a few streaming labs here, Steve. Steve, we can roll through here. Justin T. 1977 says, hi, guys. You brought up why I love this movie. Arnold doesn't beat the Predator with his strength or guns. He has to outsmart him. He lays traps, uses the night, the jungle. When they go one-on-one, he gets his ass kicked and only wins via the tree trap. Yeah, right?
Exactly.
What do you think about that?
I think that intelligence is almost always the best way to end action sequences. Is that, mm-hmm. You get to story, and this is the one place this isn't true is in the good Rocky movies.
Yeah,
is that Rocky is all about him just having the will to continue, and right. So he doesn't come up with any cool smart thing to do. But in general, you want your characters to do something cool and smart. You know, mm-hmm. that's and sometimes in martial arts or action movies, it's the technique that we see them do, the way mm-hmm. they fight, in general, it's. That we could go right back to the climax of Jaws is mm-hmm. that he gets the tank in the mouth and he shoots it and says, smile, you son of a bitch, and blows up the shark. Mm-hmm. That is cool and smart. And I think that, tying yourself up to the fire hose and jumping off the side of the building, that is an amazing idea and a dramatic way to end a film. So yeah, 100% agree.
Absolutely. Drunken Prayer says, good to see you, Drunken Prayer. He says, Steve, Commando is awesome. That is all. Okay, I guess I'll ask a question. Do you think Predator 2 is unfairly maligned? It's not as good as the first one, but I still think it's a fun action movie with some great set pieces. I can't agree with that, but Steve, what do you think?
I think we've already talked about this, but I literally don't think I've seen it in 30 years. So if I saw it again, I could offer an opinion, but I can't remember it. Okay.
Maybe that'll be a separate tier. We have to watch these old movies again. All right. One last one here, and it's incredible donation. Thank you very much, Matthew Gramlich. How very kind of you. He says, this is great, guys. Really fun to contribute to the conversation. Super enjoyable to hear other listeners' thoughts and questions and how that molds the conversation. This format is sweet. Yeah, well, that's why we're doing it, I think.
I'm loving doing this. It's so much fun. It's I love handing over the reins to you and letting you run the show. I love not having to edit. I love, you know, and just like, you know, having more of a conversation rather than the, you know, the Cinephiles is really structured. And so, and getting to interact with all of you out there is just, it's great. I have a ball.
It's a lot of fun to do it for sure. And it's in my wheelhouse. This is what I do with my eyes closed. So it's great. D Duval 59 says, when I first saw Predator 2, age 7 on HBO, I was scared of the dark for 2 weeks. I think it's one of the best monster designs of all time. And I think Stan Winston deserves credit for saving the movie from that awful first design. Do you think the first design is awful?
I don't. You know what? I don't know what it looks like. Do you?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, from the movie, I just saw the movie this morning.
No, he means that the one they threw out.
That's when
they had Jean-Claude Van Damme, and then they had this terrible suit, and they brought Stan Winston in to redesign.
Okay. Let me see if we can find it.
Now you kind of want to find it, yeah.
Yeah.
I found it.
Is it terrible?
It's not nearly as cool as the one that we ended up with.
Oh. Interesting. Okay. Oh. Yikes. All right, let me see if I can I think I can do this. Let's see here. Where is it? Is it on the, there we go. All right. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. That's what it looks like. I don't want to go to the website. That's what it looks like right there. That looks is that the one you saw or is that a different
one? No, that's what I saw.
That's that looks like something out of The Fly from 1986. That seems weird to me.
And by the way, seeing Predator at age 7, I understand why you're scared of the dark.
I would be too, yeah.
I think the design's phenomenal. I don't think, I mean, nothing can quite beat the Giger designs of Alien, but
oh yeah,
I think the Predator design is a great, interesting, iconic look.
Yeah, agreed. Gaslight Troubadour says, Predator 2 is better than all that little horseshit they keep releasing lately. All right, well, I think you can make a case for that. What else have we got, Steve? Anything else on your side of things? Any other Patreon questions?
Nope, that's all the Patreon questions we have. Okay. But definitely, if you join Patreon, you can submit your own questions, and you can see how detailed and thoughtful some of our patrons are. Those are fantastic questions, and there's lots of fun stuff going on over there. So,
Patreon.com/
Oh, that's right there.
Right above the head, for sure. But if you're listening to us on the podcast, it's Patreon.com/TheCinephiles. For you to go sign up. Justin Toner says, Kevin Peter Hall replaced JCVD as the Predator. Talk about things working out. Van Damme in the suit would have created a different movie, I think.
Yeah. 100%.
Mm-hmm. But certainly also would have created maybe a different feeling about Van Damme. You know, not many people who play these characters or these people in suits get to transfer over and become leads of series of movies and action stars. That's a really, really rare thing in the world of Hollywood. So maybe it worked out for him better that people didn't see him as a guy who was in the suit in the Predator suit overall.
Well, so, yeah. And the thing is to getting a guy who moves great and putting them in a big, heavy suit is a misguided idea because he's not going to be able to move that great. Plus the other thing about it, and maybe this relates to the Jaws thing, because they didn't know how they were going to do the heat vision. You know, they didn't know how they were going to do the Predator effect. They had to figure all the things. They actually tried to shoot with night goggles in the jungle that would sense heat, and it totally didn't work because it was 90 degrees out, and so the jungle was 90 degrees. And so there wasn't a lot of color difference between the humans and the jungle. So it didn't work. And what they ended up doing was that's a negative of the film that they then super color corrected in all these weird ways. And it works great, but they didn't know how they were going to do any of that. And so you would have ended up with some really crappy Predator fight scene stuff when what is making it work is not seeing the Predator very much. That's what makes it work.
Right, you know? Kind of like Jaws, not seeing the Predator very much for sure. You know, they shot this thing in Mexico, Steve, and from what I'm seeing here, both McTiernan and Schwarzenegger lost 25 pounds on the film.
Yep.
Schwarzenegger on purpose, McTiernan because he didn't want to eat any of the Mexican food there for fear of what it would do to his body. Apparently, a number of the crew got traveler's diarrhea down in Mexico because of the water and all this stuff. This is before this was kind of really well known as a thing not to do, for sure. So, you know, you pay the price for the things you choose to do in life. You got to be aware of it for sure. What did you feel about Alan Silvestri's score as we wrap up here over the next 8 minutes? Thoughts overall on like what he was able to compose and create, and does it really kind of give the film extra life when you hear his score throughout, pulsating throughout the movie?
I think it's great. I think it's a really good score. I think it has a great sense of adventure for the adventurous parts, creepy for the creepiest parts. And then they kind of sampled, it sounds like Copland, Fanfare for the Common Man, is what, you know, there's for the sad stuff, for when, you know, Bill Duke is saying goodbye to Jesse Ventura. There's like that great sort of military sounding thing that totally is Copland-ish. Like, I think this score is great. What about you?
Yeah, I love the score. You know, I've been studying for the Showdown with these matches this year, and one of the things that I'm not the best at is scores and soundtracks. So I've been doing it more and more, so I'm more aware of scores in movies and then memorizing them in my mind. And I thought, I thought this was fantastic to hear it. And at this time, with Predator, he'd really, of note, he'd done Romancing the Stone, Back to the Future, and then not really much of that are good movies that you could, and then boom, Predator happens. Frame Roger Rabbit is the next year. The Abyss is a year after that. And then it just kind of takes off from there for him as a composer, to where he's composing Avengers movies. So it's certainly, this is an integral movie, or a huge movie in Alan Silvestri's resume, and kind of launches him into a whole nother echelon as well as a composer.
Totally, totally, totally agree.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Any last things we want to touch on, Steve, before we wrap up here? This review and analysis and breakdown and conversation on Predator. The hour and a half seems to have flown by, brother.
For me, I think, you know, it's funny because I put it on when I recorded the preview for this, is that this movie so represents an era for me of getting together with the guys in a stack of VHS tapes. You know what I mean? Like, this is just, oh, well, you want to put in Predator again? Oh, you want to watch, you know, Escape from New York again? Oh, we're going to watch Raw Deal? Great. You know, whatever it was. And of course, later Die Hard and Lethal Weapon, that was just an amazing time of not having that many responsibilities and hanging out with your, you know, 20-year-old guy friends and watching stacks of 80s action movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, I want to cite some when the film came out. The film was made for, I think, $15 to $18 million, and it made $98.3 million in 1980s money. So that's a lot of money in 1980s money, for sure. Some of the critics weren't that positive about it. Elvis Mitchell said it was grisly and dull with a few surprises. Michael Wilmington of the Los Angeles Times said it was arguably one of the emptiest, feeblest, most derivative scripts ever made. Variety says that it was slightly above average actioner that tries to compensate for a tissue thin plot with ever more grisly death sequences. But Roger Ebert was positive about the movie and said that it moves at a breakneck pace. It has strong and simple characterizations, terrific special effects, and supplies what it claims to supply, an effective action movie. The Hollywood Reporter called it a well-made old-style assault movie overall. And now, and my friend William Bibbiani, when doing a re-review of the movie in 2018, he said that Predator was the most subversive action movie of the 1980s. Predator may be a big macho action movie, but it's also highly critical of the kinds of characters you'd normally find in big macho action movies and the superficial, unquestionably heroic stories they appear in. So interesting stuff to hear from a number of critics. Steve?
The negative reviewers to me so fall into the category of judging a movie based on the fact that it's not your taste, you know?
Right.
Like, you know, this is not supposed to be, an intellectual film. Like, this isn't My Left Foot. This isn't Schindler's List. This isn't, you know, this isn't Jules and Jim, or, you know, this is Predator for what it, how does it do at doing what it is trying to do?
Yeah.
And in my opinion, it does great.
I think that's the approach I always have with film criticism when I do any reviews. I put it in the box of what was the film trying to do. I don't like to be like some. I gave one of the Transformer films, I think a 7 or 8 one time, and my fellow people at the outlet I was at were like, "Why would you do that?" I said, "For a Predator film, I'm sorry, for a Terminator of a Transformers film, it is this level. This is the ranking I give it. Overall, I wouldn't give it the ranking that, but for a Transformers film." This is the right, and that's the way I look at movies. What's it trying to do? So I agree with you 1,000%, Steve. Take it for what it is. Don't try to grade it through the prism of is it a Hitchcock or Orson Welles or Antonio Nini film. It is a fun turn your mind off, have some fun action film. But if you want to turn your mind on, you can catch some of the symbolism and subversiveness and what have you that McTiernan is doing in this for real. All right, let's see here. One last question. Alex Ainsworth wants to know, Steve, what's your favorite McTiernan film that's not Predator, Die Hard or Red October?
Well, that's tough. I don't think, because nothing he makes lives up to these three, in my opinion. I like Thomas Crown Affair. I like 13th Warrior. Those ones probably.
Oh, really? More, so you can't decide, so not Die Hard or Red October? Oh, which one that's not these three films?
Yeah. It was an easier question before, right?
Yeah, I thought for sure we were going to battle over that, but I think, let me look real quick. I would say the Thomas Crown Affair. That's my favorite one. That's a sexy
good movie.
Yeah, absolutely. We got one more. Sorry. If this original movie was to be rebooted, how would you like it to be and who would you cast? Oh, and we never answered who we'd be in the movie, Steve. We should answer that to wrap up.
Who would we be in the movie? It's a weird question because I'm like, is it who I would want to be? Is it whose personality am I most like? I probably would be Carl Weathers, I guess. Okay.
All right. I'd like to think I'd be Dutch, but I think I'd be Sonny Landham. I think I'd be Billy. I'd like to think I'd be Dutch, but I think I'd be Billy.
Yeah, I'd like to think I'd be Dutch, but that's I don't think I can pull that off.
I think if I'm leading my Finstock exchange, I would be Dutch. But if I'm with other people, I might be Billy. Who would you cast in the movie? A couple of people, just throw out two or three other people if you
will. Well, the first thing, because they kind of said, how would you like it? Which I assume, like, what kind of movie would you like it to be? Mm. I would like to do this is the ultimate in macho-ness. That's what Predator is.
Yeah.
And so I would like to not do that. That I would do characters that are more unusual, more quirky, you know, like instead of having the big muscle people, you have the more ninja-y people. Mm. You know what I mean? And I definitely would have some women in the ensemble. Definitely would have some people that maybe you wouldn't expect as much. That's my first thought so far.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think it'd be more multicultural. Even though this is pretty multiracial, this pretty ethnic cast, you would say there's Native American, black people, white people, and Latino. So that's fine. I think for what it is, it's pretty progressive for the time. But I think I would add more women for sure to be a part of it, to be a little more of, and I think I'd add a little more intelligence to it in terms of deciphering things and battle plans and military approach. And I think I'd lean even harder on the making fun of the macho stuff and then having the macho stuff actually play an important part in winning the battle so that it's in certain places, it's necessary, but it shouldn't be the overt approach to things and the only approach to things. So I think in that way, I'd make it a little more nuanced for sure. Yeah. Sorry.
You know who I'd have is the Seven Samurai. What's the name? Takashi Shimura is have the older character who leads more with intelligence, less macho. That's what I would be thinking about.
Well, that's what they wanted to do with Predators, Steve, but Schwarzenegger didn't want to come back. The Lawrence Fishburne character was essentially supposed to be Schwarzenegger. Oh. And so that would have been really, really interesting to see him as the older guy, like Takashi Shimura, telling the younger people how to battle these Predators for sure. Gina Carano would be dope in a Predator. Probably, if you can get past some of her politics, I guess so. But I don't think that's happening anytime soon, especially for Disney, who owns the film. I like this. Fillmore says, I'd start with The Rock, Batista, John Cena, and Michael B. Jordan. Perfect. Fuck it.
Wow. Good casting.
That's a great cast. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get on out of here. Thank you all so much for joining us here on the Cinephiles live stream. We appreciate it madly. Thanks for all the kind donations, the super chats, and the Streamlabs. They mean so much to us. And we're going to be doing this every month. We never know what film we're going to talk about. Well, Steve and I will discuss it, and then we'll announce it through the social media. Thanks to Luke for all the work he's doing with us promoting this stuff as well. Steve, where can they find you? And anything we need to say about the Cinephiles, please take it away.
Well, you can find me at SR Morris. It says right under my name. That's on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. The Cinephiles, you can follow at Cine_Files on Twitter. The Cinephiles podcast on Instagram. Please subscribe to the show either right here on YouTube, or you can leave your comments, or on Apple Podcasts, where please leave your reviews. We got a bunch of really nice reviews lately, and every single one of them is appreciated. As you heard many times, you can support the show at patreon.com/thecinephiles. And this Cinephiles live thing, it's a new thing. And so we'd always like to hear if you have thoughts about movies that you'd like us to do in this format rather than the regular format. You're always welcome to suggest them, particularly if you support the show on Patreon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can always follow me at The Roka Says on Twitter and on Instagram. Please remember to subscribe to the Cinephiles channel as well. It is a monetized channel now, so the more subscribers we get, the more comments, the more likes. Those are important, so please hit a like button on this as well and leave a comment down below and share it on all your social media to get more people involved and know that this is a new daily, a new monthly show that we're doing for the Cinephiles here that people can come and interact with us and just hang out and talk about a movie for an hour and a half and hear from you all and answer your questions. All right. Take care of yourself.
I'm sorry, John, just one more thing, because Justin Toner did my job better and reminded me that to say that I have a new podcast on Star Trek, the original series with Scott Mance called Enterprise Incidents. We are about to release The Man Trap. I think that's the next episode coming out. Right on. So thank you, Justin, for reminding me.
There you go. All right. We're out of here. Take care of yourselves. Please go get vaccinated. Wear your mask. Practice social distancing. And we'll catch you next time on the Cinephiles Live. Take care. Peace.